This is exactly right.
On the 12th season of Tenfold More Wicked, we investigate a series of compelling mysteries from the city of Fall River, Massachusetts, where problems started generations before Lizzie Borden's murders made her a household name. Join me as we cover the misfortunes that have befallen this infamous town for more than 150 years, including the Great Fire of 1843. Season 12 premieres Monday, May 13th on Exactly Right. Follow Tenfold More Wicked on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Wake up. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning and welcome
to your favorite morning talk show.
My favorite murder.
The morning talk show that screams in your face to wake
get
you
down.
Up. Get down. Get up.
Get up.
Get down.
Get back down. Get back up again.
And then you're like, what? What do they want from me?
We want a couple crunches. Easy.
Yeah.
Simple.
Just to wake you up.
Fun.
Fun and easy.
Get the blood going.
Yeah. Burpees?
Just fucking start burping.
What if burpees were not an exercise, but just belching? I would be a fucking Olympian.
You absolutely would.
I would.
You'd be internationally known.
Mm.
Are burpees the ones where you jump up and go down into a push-up and jump up? Because I was thinking of Herkies, which is a cheerleading jump.
Oh, God.
Where you kind of look like a check. You turn your body into like a check mark.
Check.
And I was going to be like, wouldn't it be great if
it doesn't work.
It's such
like,
a pain.
Like, oh, and you mean your legs go forward. Check.
One leg goes straight out.
Uh-huh.
And then the other leg comes up in, your knee comes to your chest.
Don't do that. That's just back problems for your life.
It's like this, but in the air.
Okay. Take it from me.
Everyone at home, I'm way up in the air.
she just showed me one in the middle of the living room. It was amazing.
Also, what am I talking about? I don't fucking know technically what a herky is. Like,
you're a cheerleader?
It's like I'm trying to get people to email us about things. I was a cheerleader, by the way.
Oh, my God.
I was a song leader junior year of high school.
Oh, my God.
Those were the ones that, like, did routine. Well, we were a small school, so we only had a certain amount of people anyway. But, you know, we did dance routines to Janet Jackson's Control.
Sure. It's all about control.
It's all about control. That's the only one I remember. Just that we had, you know, gloves that were white on the inside and blue on the outside.
What? You're like blowing my mind.
So then you do a lot of this and you switch it.
Like a clown.
White to blue.
Like a mime, but white, blue.
White, blue. White, blue. Oh, and then like, eyes.
And then one is this way and one is this way. So it's white, blue.
That's right.
Then change it up. Then white,
and
blue.
And then boom.
And then change
and
it
yeah.
up.
Yeah.
5, 6, 7, 8.
And
change it up. And then this is my favorite murder.
Put your gloves up by your face.
Are they white or are they blue?
Okay, this is one of my favorite parts about having this podcast is I get random texts from my beautiful friends who listen to it, who take the time to listen to it.
Oh, wow.
And then, but they sometimes can be months behind. Yeah. So the other day, my beautiful friend, Sam Pancake, that's his real name, who plays Dorothy in the live Golden Girls that I told you about and love so much.
I have the mug. Thank you for being a cunt. That you got
still,
me.
It's still at Casita del Campo. They started a new run of it.
It's amazing.
You really should go. But he sent me a text and all it said was fingers and faces. And it made me laugh so hard.
Fingers and faces. Is the best beauty shop name.
The best worst beauty shop name of all time.
Ever heard of.
Just cut to the basics. Fingers and faces.
From the live Orlando show. Boo. Photo. Remember when we were at the live Orlando show? And I'm sitting there reading my whatever. One of us is reading a murder and I just see in the audience whatever fucking production had happened the night before. Maybe it was, who could it have been? Let's say someone like not too big, not too small, but so you've heard of them. Maybe, let's see.
It could have been, you know, it could have been at like,
who's the, you might as well be walking on the sun.
Smash Mouth.
Thank you, Steven. Maybe it was Smash Mouth.
You might as well be walking on the sun. For all the good it'll do you.
You might as well.
Might
and
as well.
One sad fucking confetti piece that had been sitting there since the night before slowly falls into this lovely lady's lap in the front row.
That's right.
I was just like, it's like she was blessed. Or she's dead. I don't know.
I mean, it could have been the death confetti.
It could have been the death confetti.
It could have been so many things.
Dottie?
Is Dottie arranging papers upstairs?
Dottie's digging an inanimate object. Dottie!
You go for it.
You've been sedentary all day. The joy... Okay, you can cut that out.
The joy of kittens?
The joy of kittens. Joy, fuck sex. The joy of kittens.
That's the illustrated book you need to be reading.
Do you know I have the joy of sex? I have an old copy. I found it at a used bookstore, and I was like, well, I'm absolutely buying this.
Did anybody write in it?
I don't know. Do they write in it?
I mean, that's the first thing I would look for is like somebody folded up a piece of paper and stuck it inside. Somebody like, try this with Gary. This.
Maybe Gary will love you now.
Ask Gary to please do this. All I know is that we got me and my friend Katie Neuberger, who lived down the street. Mm-hmm. She's the one whose family had llamas, and they had the old abandoned house on their property. With the bills and the walls.
Yeah.
I'm almost positive it was at her house that we looked through that book because her mom was also a nurse. Uh-huh. And it was so, we were starting to look at it like, ooh.
Yeah.
And the illustrations are so technical and like anatomical that we got bummed out very quickly.
It's we're not
like,
interesting.
Maybe we should just go swimming instead.
It's like, and I said this last week, I talked about Reductress and their hilarious t-shirts, but they have one that's like, you know, when you see like a cow and it shows you the cuts of beef, there's one that's a vagina and it says the cuts of vagina.
Oh, no.
And it's just like the cuts. It's just in that style.
That's hilarious. I just saw one of theirs on Twitter and it said, girl who promised not to tell anybody only told two people. And then the picture is so funny because it's a girl whose face is right next to a bunch of flowers, like she's all smiling, all proud.
That's me. What about bitch? This bitch brought loose leaf tea to a fucking food donation thing. It's just like some fuck. You can tell this bitch is like some hippie bitch who doesn't wear makeup because she's gorgeous, not because she.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This bitch.
Loose leaf tea. What about Where Did I Come From? Do you remember that book?
Oh, yes.
Dude, with the fucking guy who looks like George Costanza.
Yes.
And his wife. Actually, it looks like George Costanza's parents. And it's showing them having a baby. And my mind was blown.
Well, what about the part? There is a part where they're explaining to their child about sex. And it's like, they basically say they rub on each other really fast or something. And I just remember staring. Steven's going to have a nervous breakdown.
Steven can't talk
staring
about
sex. Steven.
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 Sex. I don't know what that is.
Well, I'll tell you. It's when two fat little cartoons rub against each other. It was very, like, I remember staring at it and just being like, it can't be this.
Yeah, sex isn't just friction, right?
It can't be this. Just this little man. Oh, yeah.
It was very confusing. It was a confusing time, the 80s.
The 80s and that age and, like, before you know and then what you think you know and then when you find out.
And how funny it is, but you still can't get rid of the things you thought you knew, so it is still a little that.
And the thing I thought I knew is God can see me and it's wrong.
God can see you, but he's into it.
What?
Sorry, blasphemy.
Is that what they're teaching in the temple? God damn it.
Shit. I'm going to hell. Is there hell? I'm going there.
You don't think there's hell.
Goodbye. No.
Goodbye, hell.
There's something.
Bye, hell.
Goodbye, hell.
See you. Deuces, hell.
Peace out, motherfucker. What do you have that's sweet to talk about?
Let's see.
Besides frictional sex.
Besides describing sex cartoons from the 70s. Well, this is a great email we got. Oh. Hi, ladies. This is from Aaron. Hi, ladies. I was at the second Balboa Theater show back in October. That's San Diego, right? And was happy to get a chance to listen to that first show that was recently posted. Oh, it's not fun. Of course, I do immediately Google the Betty Broderick Murder House. It's right down the street from me and up for sale. Some great realtor spin too, quote, a home rich in history.
Shut up. Because you have to tell, right?
It says, have $2.5 million lying around.
$2.5 million live in San Diego house?
Yeah. And then she listed it. I could say the address, right? Because it's an empty house.
Yeah.
I mean, like, or...
Just say what street it's on.
It's on Cypress Avenue. Oh, where Van Morrison lives. That was a deep cut. Yeah.
Wow.
That's kind of hilarious.
Would you
not? Fun.
Would you move into a place if like murders had happened there? Would you care? Like, would you take have pause and ask your girlfriends over drinks, or like, would you be cool with it?
I think it just depends on the house. Like, if it, I think you'd have, I would have to go in and like feel it out. But if it was some really old house, yeah, I don't know.
Let's say like in the 80s or 90s, even there was a murder, even the 2000s, sort of them.
I want to, you know what? I'm being cavalier right now because I want to say I would, but I just thought of the first night in that house and I would just be out of my mind.
I feel like I would be fine, but I bet I wouldn't. I
want, any yeah. noise you heard, yeah. though.
But I don't care. I don't hear that. Do you? I mean,
but if you
alone in the house,
I mean, anything.
I feel like Vince would be more creeped out than I would, and I would pretend that I was saying no to the house on his behalf, but really it'd be because I was freaked out too, but I couldn't admit it because I have a murder podcast.
Yes, that's right. You have to use him as a human shield, always. And you can.
Always. And he can use me that's whenever right. he wants.
When he hates wrestling and can't talk about it.
Right.
He's really painted himself into a wrestling corner. He has to love it for the rest of his life.
There is no fucking doubt in my mind that that person, Vince Averill, the love of my life, will love wrestling for the rest of his life. He's going to 2 shows in the next 2 days.
And is like, he really?
Yeah. There's no worry.
You know what's really hilarious? So many people that I follow on Twitter love wrestling that I feel like I have a good historical backlog knowledge of. I mean, people post stuff.
You should constantly. Start your own wrestling podcast.
Yeah, you know what? I will. I'm going to call it my favorite wrestling podcast. I went home after our last recording and watched The End of the Fucking World.
Dude, on Netflix.
It's such a good, you have to watch it. It's everything Georgia said it was and more. I binged it all at once.
I forgot to mention that thing. So I was saying Wes Anderson, Harold and Maude, my friend Dahmer almost a little
oh,
bit.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's just so gorgeous.
It's really
it?
Well done. It's just those Brits, they know how to do some storytelling and some character
dry
development.
Humor.
Yes.
Oh, it's so good.
But those kids are such good actors.
Amazing.
Such epic. I never want to watch teens do anything, and these teens were the exception.
They were
for sure.
It's such a good show. Everyone yeah. watch it. The End of the Fucking World. You see that kid whose dad was like, my son's missing, and the cops were like, he's probably a runaway, and the dad was like, fuck that shit, and hired a fucking helicopter and found his kids crashed in a car in a ravine,
no.
still alive 30 hours later.
Shit, so like a couple of his kids were trapped in the car?
No, it was just his son.
By himself?
Yeah.
Fucking oh my
found,
God.
And the helicopter search, found the kid crashed in a fucking ravine, still alive 30 hours later. He's like,
holy shit.
This kid's not a fucking runaway.
I thought you were going to mention the...
Alive, still alive.
The kid was found alive. Yeah. Yes, he survived.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to talk about the 3 kids that escaped the house in Riverside County.
Oh, Jesus.
That were 12, like children between the ages of 9 and 27 chained to a wall.
It was like 14 kids.
Yes, and they're so emaciated they couldn't tell how old they were.
In Riverside.
And also the... my friend Karen Anderson's the one who told me to look at it, and she goes, the data is so upsetting, it looks like Jeff Daniels and Dumb and Dumber.
Oh no.
And he totally has the weirdest bangs, like page boy haircut. It's very disturbing.
The parents look very problematic.
Yeah. And have proven to be.
Right. Those poor children. Like, to be able to still imprison a 27-year-old means you've had some fucking lifelong conditioning of this poor kid.
I'll tell you that when a kid knocked on their door, I bet you, this is my theory, mm-hmm. a kid going around trying to sell like magazines or something and knocked on that door. Whoever opened that door, whatever the smell was, that kid was like, sorry, I forgot something on my bike and ran away. Like, don't you think smell. A house like that, it would just be like, it's like one weird candle in the background and everything else is dark.
How many? Yeah.
Or did they have the perfect veneer and like no one could tell?
Yeah, probably not.
I want
you gotta know. Lose. I mean, you can't. You gotta lose that veneer after a few kids.
After the 11th child just chained to the wall.
Yeah.
Fuck.
Jesus Christ.
Okay.
All right.
If you're like me, you're always looking for a story to dive into. Whether it's a family drama or a mystery to solve, the key to getting hooked is the details. I need rich visuals and intricate storylines, and June's Journey has that and more. June's Journey is a mobile mystery game that follows June Parker, a daring young woman, on a quest to uncover the truth about her sister's murder. This is your chance to test your detective skills because you'll play the game as June herself. Explore beautifully designed scenes from the 1920s, like lavish estates and gardens. And don't forget to keep an eye out for hidden clues. There are twists, turns, and catchy tunes, all leading you deeper into the thrilling storyline. And if you play well enough, you could make it to the Detective Club. There, you'll chat with other players and compete with or against them. June needs your help, but watch out. You never know which character might be a villain. Shocking family secrets will be revealed, but will you crack the case? Find out as you escape this world and dive into June's world of mystery, murder, and romance. It's all just one tap away. Discover your inner detective when you download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. That's June's Journey. Download the game for free on iOS and Android. Goodbye. Hey, Karen, you know that feeling when you're stressed out and your heart starts to pound and your mind is racing?
I do. I know it well.
Well, while there's no cure for stress, therapy can help shape your response to it. And since May is Mental Health Awareness Month, there's no better time to try Talkspace.
When you sign up for Talkspace, you'll receive a personalized match with a therapist or psychologist, typically within 48 hours.
Forbes rates Talkspace as the number one online therapy platform, plus their licensed professionals are in-network with almost all major insurance companies.
Once you meet your therapy goals, or if you want to cancel for any reason, Talkspace will provide you with a prorated refund for unused time. I feel like these days people understand the importance of therapy, but the difficult part is just taking that first step. It took me months to make my first therapy appointment. I was so scared. I had a lot of ideas in my head about it. And that's why I think Talkspace is such a good idea, because making it so approachable will just get you there sooner. Then you can actually get in there, figure out what you need, talk to an actual professional, and be on your way to solving some stuff that you might want to solve.
To celebrate Mental Health Awareness Month and the power of talking it out in therapy, Talkspace is offering our listeners $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80.
Go to Talkspace.com/MFM and use promo code SPACE80.
To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/MFM and enter promo code SPACE80 and get $80 off your first month and show your support for our show.
That's Talkspace.com/MFM. Enter promo code SPACE80.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
You're first this week?
I guess I am, yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah. You were Steven. First last week.
Okay.
Okay, so I have been on my couch. I sprained my ankle on Sunday.
Tell everyone. I saw the bruise. It's fucked up.
It's I rolled my ankle. I've already sprained both my ankles twice. This is not, I don't find talking about medical problems interesting at all, but this was kind of great because I was walking my dogs with my friend Don. He said, "Hey, did they redo that house?" I look over my shoulder like it's a Gina Tay commercial, walking the dog one direction but looking backwards.
Oh,
and I'm like, "That house over there," and just step like on the edge of the cement where the cement meets the grass, roll my ankle, listen to it snap. My friend Don, who was behind me, said that it turned at a 90 degree angle.
Oh.
And then I went down. He said it looked like I looked like a stunt woman. I went down like hand, hip, leg.
Yeah.
Like in hand, a perfect hip, line. Leg. He really liked it. But I knew immediately that it was bad.
Yeah.
And so I just got up and went in and kept
it. Like, couch, goodbye.
Yes. Elevated, iced, whatever. So tonight is the first night I've gone out and like driven.
Oh no.
It was fine. If I keep it like, you know.
Yeah.
Wrapped in static.
So you've had a long time to study your murder.
I just got really caught up in telling that whole story. I'm like, oh yeah, that's right, I'm trying to talk about this. So I've been laying in front on the couch. Uh-huh. Now I'm talking about that as if
kind of a dream.
What?
It's kind of a dream.
Well, also I do it anyway. What I realized is this sprained ankle just made me go, you have to stop living like your ankle is sprained all the time. You have to stop it.
So once your ankle is not sprained, start living.
Leave the house.
Yeah.
Go ahead and walk somewhere.
Because you know what? I guarantee there'll be sprained ankles in the future where you're going to be like, I wish I had lived my life outside of this.
Yes.
I always would know that I'd be back here at some point enjoying a sprained ankle.
The couch is forever. You might as well get up and move around while
ahead.
You can.
Go
and
ahead.
I feel like my body, because I'm so indignant and I'm so like defiance disorder based.
Yeah.
I feel like my body has to sprain my ankle like every 8 months just to be like up off the couch now.
Or get you really sick to be like, wouldn't you love to not be here right now on the fucking couch?
Stop living like you're sick and all of your joints don't work. Okay. But since I was.
Okay.
There is a Netflix movie called Murder on the Cape.
Ew.
I don't know if you've seen it. It, of course, immediately came up when it went onto Netflix in my suggestions.
Netflix knows us.
What's amazing about it, because I was, and I think you and I talked about this a little bit, but I got really addicted to those Hallmark Christmas movies over Christmas because my sister kept putting them on as a joke, but then we'd watch them for real.
Love that.
And that's, it was like always
what Christmas is for.
It is, right? Because it's, you get like some hot chocolate. We're all sitting on the couch and then it's just
make fun of TV.
It's blather.
Yeah.
It's a guy in a huge sweater.
Yeah.
Pretending he works at a Christmas tree farm.
Right. But
and,
really.
And it's always then it's like, oh, she's really smart and type A, but she had to come to this small town to do something. So, okay. So I see Murder on the Cape and I'm like, that doesn't look like an actual movie. And it doesn't look good. And I'm like, and also, I wonder which murder on which cape this is.
It checked all your boxes.
Right?
What's the thing? It herked all your boxes.
It herkied right into all my boxes. But, so I looked it up online first before I actually, I didn't want to watch it cold. I didn't want to waste my time. Sure. And the first thing that came up was an article on Decider, the website Decider, called, and the headline was Murder on the Cape is a bonkers crime story based on a true story. So they had already watched it and reviewed it and were like, this thing is like The Room, basically. So I stopped reading that article because I didn't want to, like, in case I had some of the same thoughts, I want to say that I just read the headline and then the beginning, the description, I was like, okay, I'm there.
Not plagiarizing this.
Yes,
the word bonkers is amazing.
Bonkers is my favorite
word. Why isn't it used more?
It's so funny.
Yeah.
My friend Eric DeDurian on Twitter changed his name to Linda K. Bonkers, and I laugh every time I see it. Okay.
Okay.
So this, and I highly recommend that you do your substance of choice, and that can be the Bible. It can be a glass of water. But do something to get yourself in the mood to accept what the television is giving you.
You could pour a glass of water on the Bible. That could be your thing.
And then light it on fire. But what you should do is get some white wine.
White wine.
Or ginger ale and Southern Comfort.
Okay.
You. How about some Malibu coconut liqueur?
Okay.
And Fanta.
Okay.
Lime.
Okay. Got it. Fanta lime and some.
And then a twist of lemon. whatever it needs to be.
Karen's just talking about her deathbed wish.
That seriously, I'm like, make me a grasshopper. Ugh. I almost had, when the Hawaiian nuclear strike thing came to, I was like, I mean, I might as well just. This is really bad. But anyway. Point being,
we all get it,
right?
Yeah,
I'm gonna be back on that or off that wagon the second I have a valid governmental reason.
The minute it happens, I'm gonna come over and be like, "Hey, what you doing?"
Hey, this is with one of those huge bottles of champagne.
Yeah, well, I'm not gonna bring it. I'm gonna let you, because I don't want to enable you.
Oh, you're just gonna discover me.
Like, hey, hi, just wanted to check in on you.
And then you're gonna be like, "That's weird. I guess I have champagne too." Yeah. It's gonna be a champagne party. Okay, so Murder on the Cape, the made-for-Netflix movie, is quite something, and I highly recommend you watch it. It is very much like The Room meets a... it's almost, for me, I would actually say more. It's not so bad as The Room, but there are definitely actors where you say, did you like acting before your friend decided to make this movie? Or is this something that was like you wanted to do that this weekend along with your friend who decided to make this movie? There's a lot of people making big choices, taking huge swings, really going for it. There's a lot I could see in my mind's eye these actors going, hey Chuck, or whoever the director is, I'm really gonna go for it this time.
They're like, this is what acting is, ready?
Yeah. I'm gonna kick my leg and do a dance for some reason that doesn't actually connect with what my character's doing in the scene.
God.
So that's cool. The lead guy, I feel like I saw somewhere that somebody in this movie was in a soap opera at some time.
Oh, that makes sense.
I didn't recognize anybody.
Wow.
And the story, the way the Murder on the Cape story is told, is very much against the victim, in my opinion. It's very much making her look like she tricked him in. Like, and then I thought, oh, I should actually look this up and see if there's somebody that was in the real case that is connected with writing this movie. Because it's just median quality enough. So pretty much anyone could have written it.
Fucking conspiracy theory on the cape.
I mean, you never know. You have to watch it. But she, it's like she tricked him into sleeping with her, and then she tricked him into getting her pregnant, and then she, it, and then like, and she tricked was a big him into flirt. Murdering him. Yeah. There's, her. It's a very problematic presentation. So then I looked up the actual story, because I'm like, that story sounds familiar, but it does not look familiar in Murder on the Cape.
Right.
And granted that they open it up by saying this is based on a true story, but I don't think they claim it is exact.
Okay.
So here's the real story.
Okay.
And then you can hear this story, process it and the horror of it, then clear your palate, mm-hmm. and then go back and watch that thing as then its own separate thing.
Pour your glass of water on the Bible and then go watch it.
Click.
Yeah.
Turn that TV on. Okay. So this all takes place in a town called Truro, Massachusetts, mm-hmm. which I reminded myself just, it's like you're saying churro with a T.
So it's Truro. T? Churro?
T-R-U-R-O, I believe.
Oh, whatever. That's not it.
Churro.
That's not a word.
The word is
churro. I'm already mad at it.
Okay, so it's 1997, and this is a tiny fishing village, basically, at the very top of Cape Cod. And it's busy in the summer, obviously, with vacationers, but then in the winter, it's dead, and mm-hmm. it's really cold.
Okay.
Except for all the fishermen and the families that live there,
right.
obviously. And a woman named Krista Worthington moves there in 1997. She was a very successful, at the time, 40-year-old fashion writer. She's written for Elle, Harper's, Women's Wear Daily, The New York Times. She's also co-authored books on fashion. She's a successful writer, and she had been writing internationally. She'd been doing stuff in Europe and basically living a very high stress, kind of high fashion lifestyle.
Yeah.
And so she wanted to get away from that and go up to the Cape. So her family, she came from a very prominent family, and her family owned a lot of different houses and places in Truro. Mm-hmm. When she moved there, she moved into a pink bungalow that was right next to the harbor master's shack. A couple months later, she moved out of that and into a larger house that her family owned, a really beautiful cottage.
Sign me up.
Yeah. Looking at these places in the, there's a 48 hours, one of the main ones I watched mm-hmm. is a 48 hours all about it. And they just keep showing clips of like a ship just kind of going around, like along the coastline and like, you know, an icebreaker. It's just like awesome looking.
However, 2 weeks till you're bored out of your fucking mind.
I mean,
$20.
You know, you got to have your Netflix.
Sure.
Got maybe like some crossword puzzles.
You know, Wi-Fi is spotty out there.
Yeah, that's true. That would make you nuts.
Right.
You'd be getting on that jitney back into town a bunch of times. Is there a jitney from Massachusetts?
I've never heard that word before, so I couldn't tell you.
Jitney is a word I learned from my New York friends. They jump onto it it's like a little bus that drives strictly to like the Hamptons or something.
Oh.
From Manhattan.
Ooh.
Or some like summer, it's the summertime jitney. Okay. You go out to the beach.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So on January 6th, 2002... 20 to 5 in the afternoon, a guy named Tim Arnold, who is Krista Whittington's neighbor on the other side of the woods, drops by her house to return a flashlight. And inside, he finds her dead body. She's been stabbed on the left side of the chest, and she's on the kitchen floor. Her 2-year-old daughter, Ava.
Mm-mm.
Is there next to her, clutching her.
Mm. 2 years old.
So, yeah. She's been with the body for a while. Tim grabs up Ava and runs out, calls 911. Police come. They find that Chris has been stabbed through the chest. The knife missed her heart. It pierced her lung, and she bled out on the kitchen floor.
Oh, my God.
This murder is the first murder that Truro has seen in 30 years. So, holy like, nothing happens in this tiny town anyway. Yeah. And, like, nothing like this. So, of course, everyone's freaking out. And, you know, they later on, the defense lawyer will claim that the EMTs were sloppy and compromised the crime scene. Mm-hmm. They did throw a blanket over Krista's body when they got there to cover her up. She'd been raped. And luckily the police did find DNA on her body that they ended up sending to the lab.
Okay.
So they knew that there was somebody else's DNA on the body, and that could be a good lead. Unfortunately, the lab was insanely backed up. It was 1997. Yeah. So this was like, you know, so they start talking to the people in Krista's life. They talk to Tim Arnold, the neighbor. They find out he wasn't just her neighbor. He was also her ex-boyfriend. They dated for about a year. He says he has nothing to do with her death. Then in talking to her friends, they find out that Ava's father is a married man who was born and raised in Truro. And his name is Tony Jacket.
Now, what the fuck? Why do we keep getting these names? Jesus.
Now, it does have two T's, but I mean, that's right on par with Jimmy Buttons in terms of a noun name.
Buttons, Jacket, there's an onion.
I mean, just is, if this was writing, it would be lazy, but it's not. Yeah. It's just how it happens.
Oh my God.
So it turns out Tony Jacket, he's lived in Truro all his life. I'm only going to call him Tony Jacket the whole time. And he has six kids. He's married, but, and this is in the 48 hours and by his own account, he saw Krista when she moved into that pink bungalow right by the harbor master shack, because he was working there as the fishing warden. In the 48 hours, he calls himself the fishing warden. An article I found on abcnews.com referred to him, and I'm not joking, as the shellfish constable.
What the fuck?
Now, I don't know if that writer for abcnews.com was bored and just being funny,
or just reading cartoons. It sounds like a cartoon.
Or pitching an idea for SpongeBob SquarePants episode.
Yes.
Where the shellfish constable rolls into town.
Yeah, I had the same thought. If that's a cartoon name.
It totally is. In the movie, the Netflix film Murder on the Cape, the character that plays Tony Jacket's character is very ashamed to be the shellfish constable. And he was, I think, a contractor, and he couldn't get work. And so this was his way of, like, because they were, you know, the family was having financial problems. He has six kids.
Jesus, seriously.
So he had to, you know, take the job. Anyway, as he's working as a shellfish constable, he sees Krista, this beautiful, very, you know, very fashionable, very, you know, all the pictures of her. She's just a gorgeous woman. Mm-hmm. And they immediately hit it off and are attracted to each other.
So she's like this high society. He's just like gruff, smelly, local, but kind of hot local, probably.
Yes. He's very, he looks like he should have been like a third string character in The Sopranos. He has like big lips and squinty eyes and like combed back hair.
Mm-hmm.
Very kind of like Mambo Italiano. Uh-huh. I can't explain it.
Got it.
And I'm not against it. I'll say that. not judgment.
Like, get yours. Get your sea constable or whatever the fuck.
Get your shellfish constable Italian piece.
D.
Okay. So when they first get together, Krista tells Tony she can't have kids. She's been told she can't have kids. Mm-hmm. They have their affair for a year. They end up breaking up. In the film Murder on the Cape, they make it look like she won't leave him alone and is like always trying to be in his business and finding him at the grocery store and stuff, where I'm like, prove that.
Yeah.
It seems like she had plenty of dudes in her life and it wasn't,
and
like
she needed
desperate
fucking
for this one.
Romaine lettuce. Where else is she going to go?
And it's a tiny, truly tiny town.
Right. Like, I run into my fucking ex at the grocery store and this is fucking Los Angeles. Like,
for real.
Maybe he's stalking me.
I can't.
Don't run into my ex.
I have never run into anyone I didn't want to run into in this town. I swear. And I, why, I have to knock on wood now.
Knock on wood.
Why would I ever say that out loud?
I don't know.
I just want, like, open the nightmare door, basically.
Ooh, next week's going to be fun when we talk about who you run into. Yeah.
Oh, I better start wearing so much mascara.
All of the makeup.
Constant makeup. It'll be so different. Okay. Basically, she comes to him and says, I'm pregnant, mm-hmm. and it's your baby. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you told me you couldn't have babies. And then she's like, well, it's a miracle, and that's why I'm keeping it. I don't care what you say, and you don't need to be a part of it.
Yeah.
And he said in the 48 hours, he was like, I was dumbfounded, and he kind of thought she tricked him. But she goes on and has her life and starts to raise her daughter, Ava, herself. But at some point, she asked Tony not only to pay child support, but she wants him to tell his wife mm-hmm. that he has a daughter. Mm. So Tony Jacket ends up telling his wife of like how many years of six kids and years that he had an affair and now he has this daughter.
Jackets.
The jackets. The jackets.
Come off.
The jackets had to come off that night. So basically, wow. His wife Susan, of course, is very upset at first and livid at him, but then she ends up meeting Krista, mm-hmm. and Krista comes over for dinner and brings the baby.
Oh no.
And they start to make it work.
Susan
herself tells the story in the 48 hours.
Women are the best people.
Women are just like, this is a kid that is not gonna like right. have her life be bad because of
fucking jackets over here.
Because of Captain Jacket.
That I fucking married. Oh man.
So, and she says she actually liked her. Wow, and basically,
that's amazing.
I know. But also, Susan provides Tony's alibi. He was home with her the night of Krista's death.
Okay.
So, the police are like, it's all a little weird.
Yeah.
But then they also discover Krista was having issues with her 72-year-old father. They were, you know, as I said, like this prominent family, and apparently the 72-year-old father now had a 29-year-old girlfriend.
What?
Her name was Elizabeth Porter. She had been a sex worker and she had been a heroin addict, and now she had gotten her life together and she was dating the love of her life, 72-year-old.
Dad, you're embarrassing me.
And Krista was like, you are spending too much money on this woman. And then they cut in the 48 hours, they fucking do a hard cut to this woman, Elizabeth Porter, walking down like a courtroom thing. And she goes, y'all like to take pictures of me, don't ya? And she has like this insane cigarette voice.
Fuck.
And she's just yelling at all the cameras at once.
Oh like, my God.
Not handling her shit at all.
So he wasn't like, no, I've met this classy dame. And listen, I'm not talking shit on her being a sex worker or a heroin addict. Date a sex worker and heroin addict, but a 29-year-old and a 72-year-old don't belong together.
I mean, you don't know any of the same references.
No.
You don't use any of the same emojis.
No. Or hair products.
Or gifts.
Or anything.
Or you don't listen to the same podcast.
I mean, overall, the rule is don't date someone younger than your children.
Yes.
Dad. I'm mad please. At the dad for being a fucking creepazoid.
But I mean, I know a lot of people that have had that happen where they're like, and now my stepmom's younger than me.
That's just an obvious no.
I know. I shouldn't say a lot of people. Yeah. I know one person.
That'd be great if you knew a lot of people. I would be so impressed.
These are the tiny ways I constantly lie. It just comes out as a lot of people. And I'm like, just the one.
But you're not hurting anyone because I'm like, cool, tell me.
But so that was actually, they were like, well, this could actually be because she was complaining to her father and basically saying, stop spending money, cut her off. So then, and you know, so it does become, and it sounded like it was this thing where this is almost like a vacation town. It's the elite, the people Jesus. With the money in the town, and then the people who make the town go.
Right. And they all kind of hate each other.
I mean, it all could get real, you know.
Yeah. Who us knows? Versus them.
So the police are just like, it can be anybody.
So they're thinking dad's girlfriend hired someone to kill her, maybe?
Or they're just looking at that girlfriend, that she doesn't have the best background, and she would have reason to get rid of her to be like, yeah, I want to keep my money source open.
Thank God my dad is poor. because I mean, otherwise
it does solve a lot of problems.
Yeah. No one's going to date. No 29-year-old's going to date him unless they're in love with him and they have my fucking blessing.
And that's nice. I know. That would be nice.
Then I'm happy.
Mare. Okay.
Mare.
So, they get the police. There's so much going on now and there's so many suspects. The police go to the FBI to get help and to get a profile drawn up. The profile that the FBI gives them doesn't help them. It does. They don't have anybody that matches it. Finally, a year after, Chris's murder, lab results come back and they find out the DNA that they found on her body doesn't match any of these suspects. So none of these ex-boyfriends, nobody. And they're like, what the fuck? So they have to start all over again. So what they decide to do is ask for the DNA of every man who lives in Truro.
Holy shit.
And there's a reporter in this 48 hours who was like the reporter from day one who was told his whole story. Yeah. And he was like, well, then that was just crazy. And then it just, you clearly they have nothing and they're just like trying to do whatever. But
how many men are we talking?
I don't know offhand.
Sorry.
Normally I would have lied, but I caught
myself.
Let's
say 1500.
Let's just go ahead with 15,000 because it's fun and it's a good number. It's a really small town.
Yeah.
Let's say 200.
Okay.
Let's say between 200 and 9,000.
Great.
Okay. So 2.5 years later, the DA, Michael O'Keefe, announces they've gotten a match back from the DNA. And
some idiot killer gave them their DNA?
Yeah, well, yes. And it leads to the arrest of a suspect named Christopher McGowan. He is her garbage man. So police first bring him in for questioning. The police say, do you know Krista Worthington? He says, no, I just know she's a stop on my garbage route, but I've never met her and I don't know her. Mm-hmm. And they say, okay, well, we found your DNA on her body. Mm-hmm. Now what do you have to say? Yeah. And he says, well, actually, I went to her house on Thursday, which is the day that he picks up the garbage at her house. Mm-hmm. And then I went inside and we had consensual sex. Uh-huh. And then, he says he went back Friday, had sex with her, then beat her. But his friend Jeremy Fraser was there. His friend Jeremy Fraser started beating her up. And then he left and Jeremy Fraser's the one that stayed and killed her.
What?
Well, the police are like, well, that's a great story, except for your friend Jeremy Fraser, your good friend that you're setting up for this murder. None of his DNA is anywhere in the house. And there's no way to prove that he was ever anywhere there.
Oh, my God.
And so then basically, after a 6-hour interrogation, he signs a waiver that says he doesn't want a lawyer. And then he confesses to the murder. So
this guy does? The same guy?
Christopher McGowan, okay. The garbage man.
Okay.
So basically, the prosecution, so the trial starts. The prosecution tells everybody that Christopher McGowan went out with his friend, Jeremy Fraser, and they got drunk. And then at 1 a.m., he drives up to her house, rapes her, and kills her. But Christopher McGowan's defense attorney is a guy named Bob George. He claims Krista had consensual sex with McGowan on Thursday, the day he picked up the garbage. Mm-hmm. Then he left, and that her murder took place somewhere between Thursday and then when her body was found on Sunday, and that his client had nothing to do with it.
God damn it.
He also suggested that Christopher McGowan and Krista Worthington could have been having a consensual affair for a while, and that it was just the elitists of this town that didn't believe that a white woman who is this fancy fashion writer mm-hmm. could be having a consensual affair with a black man who was the garbage man. Mm-hmm. He also submitted that McGowan's IQ was in the low 70s. Oof. And so that's why he waived the right for the lawyer. He had no chance once he was in the police. But he basically said, but then, you know, so he's basically saying his IQ is really low. So he was tricked into all mm-hmm. of this and he's just basically the perfect patsy. Mm-hmm. Well, then the prosecution comes back and says he's smart enough to have lied to say he didn't know her.
Right.
He, you know, there's like a lot of evasion tactics or whatever. So he clearly, it is not, just because he didn't score well on that IQ test doesn't mean that he isn't tricky and doing whatever he wants.
Totally.
The defense also alleges that the crime scene was totally contaminated by sloppy EMTs because those EMTs came in and put a blanket on Chris's body when they first saw her. And so the DNA, who knows whose DNA was on that blanket, whatever. They kind of just keep introducing reasons to doubt. So Krista had an ex-boyfriend who lived in Manhattan, who was in this 48 hours, who says if Krista was having an affair with the garbage man, because he had visited her 2 weeks before her murder, and he said that would have been the first thing she said when I walked in the door, because she would have loved that story. She would have been very proud of it. If she was having some kind of like, you know, it's not May December, but it's like, the wrong side of the tracks affair.
Illicit affair.
She was the kind of person that would love to talk about that.
Totally.
So up until 2 weeks before her murder, that was not happening.
Right.
So he basically kind of, it was interesting when he talked about that, where it's like, you can totally see that.
Yeah.
Basically, the trial goes, on November 16th, 2006, he's found guilty. Christopher McGowan is found guilty of first degree murder with extreme atrocity, aggravated rape, and aggravated armed burglary. And after the verdict is read, Christopher McGowan makes a statement to the court where he says, quote, I never meant for this to ever take place. And then after he says that, he claims to still be innocent.
Wow.
Which is a really weird way to say it if you're innocent. He is serving 3 concurrent life terms in prison without the possibility of parole. So after all of that, the verdict comes down. In January of 2008, several jurors came forward and claimed that there was a racial bias in the jury room during the deliberations. Hmm. So all 12 jurors got called back to court by that judge, and they all were questioned over those claims. And their testimony revealed that there was racial tension in the jury room. Hmm. So because of that, Christopher McGowan's lawyer used that information as grounds to file a motion for a retrial, but that was struck down, as have all 3 appeals that McGowan's defense attorneys have filed on his behalf since he got sentenced. And then in 2012, the defense attorney, Bob George, was convicted of money laundering, and he himself served 3 years in prison.
What?
Yes. So the very much, I mean, I don't know. There's a lot of things that get introduced in this case in this 48 hours that defense attorney, Bob George, he actually did a really good job of introducing all these possible doubts into this case. But at the end of the day, it's DNA.
Yeah.
And his was the only DNA on her body.
And she was raped and murdered. Which would have meant there would have been someone else's DNA there.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's funny because that 48 hours is kind of old, and it's interesting how it feels like they keep pointing to this idea that she, quote, had a lot of boyfriends. That seemed to be at play in the way people kind of like judged this.
Yeah. That and like she had an affair with a married man, where it's like, she was not to be trusted somehow.
Yeah. Or there was, I don't know. I didn't like it.
And the movie did that too.
The movie was crazy. The movie was all about fucking Tony Jackets, the character that was representing him, and like how tough his life was, and how all these women were making his life really tough. And there's
poor fucking baby.
You have to see it. It's pretty amazing. And there's also the casting is fucking fascinating. The woman who plays Tony Jackett's wife, a couple times I was like, is that Bridget Everett? You know the comic?
Bridget Everett?
Because it looked like her. And it was this kind of like, everything had it was right on the verge of being campy.
Yeah.
And then would just come back every time to boring.
When they made the movie, did they know who the killer was? And then they showed that's what happened?
Yes. Although I'm pretty sure I fell asleep before the end of the movie.
Because how can you victim blame throughout a movie and then it turns out it's just some fucking
other guy,
psycho murderer?
Yes.
You know what I mean? It wouldn't matter if she was, let's say, promiscuous or not. I'm not saying she was, but it wouldn't fucking matter.
It doesn't matter anyway. Yeah. It's like that thing that happened, happened. Yeah. That's the case that needs to get solved. I mean, it's crazy. Yeah, I think at the end of this thing, it's they leave it super vague.
Like, maybe he didn't.
Right.
But it's like, no, he did.
Yeah. But I recommend everyone go, because it's this bizarre crossroads of, it's almost like every bad reenactment you've ever seen, yeah, if all the reenactors had lines.
Jesus.
Whereas, like, you know what? Play with this scene and figure out what happened with you guys.
I want to see crazy. Susan Jackets gets her groove back, where she leaves her fucking cheating husband. Goes to an island. Is it Susan?
It's Susan Jackets.
It is now.
Susan Jackets.
Wow, that's fucked up.
It's crazy. But the little girl, the good news is,
oh, yeah,
the little girl went to live with the person that Krista Worthington chose to be her. To be the guardian, uh-huh, which is a good friend of hers.
Oh.
But Tony Jackets and Susan have visited her, and now she's like in college.
Oh, good.
And she's doing great.
Honey. So,
yeah.
Fly. You're a bird. Fly. I don't know. Spread your wings, you know? That's my words of encouragement.
I bet that'll work.
Spread your wings. Spread your wings and stuff. Wow.
Crazy. Well,
I mean, it's almost like a good thing that your ankle got twisted.
It's almost a good thing that I watch TV 24 hours a day.
Finally, something good came out of it.
Georgia, have you ever been blown away by the most simple dish at a restaurant, like perfectly scrambled eggs?
Oh my God, yes, Karen. And then all I want to do is make that dish at home and eat it every day.
Well, you probably could, as long as you have the chef's secret ingredient, Made In cookware.
Made In was created to bring restaurant quality performance kitchenware to home chefs around the world.
For years, they've built their business by supplying restaurants and top chefs with high-end cookware. Some of Tom Colicchio's most treasured dishes at his restaurant Craft are made in Made In.
Whether you're cooking for professional critics or just the critics you live with, your meals will benefit from the quality of Made In products.
Like their carbon steel cookware, it combines the best of both cast iron and stainless steel clad, so it's rugged enough for grills or an open flame. It's the MVP of summer cookouts and cook-ins. What I really love about Made In cookware is that it actually makes something like having a Memorial Day barbecue much more convenient, because you can keep everything on the grill. If you need to throw, say, a pan of garlic up on the top while you're grilling your steaks on the bottom, it's strong enough, durable enough to do that.
If you want to take your cooking to the next level, remember what so many great dishes have in common. They're all Made In, Made In.
Save up to 25% this Memorial Day from May 18th through May 27th when you visit madeincookware.com.
That's M-A-D-E-I-N cookware.com.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
There's something about the sound of an old-timey cash register that really takes me back.
I know. It sounds like someone is about to hand me an ice cream cone, but it also sounds like we just sold some merch.
That's right. And if you're a Shopify user like us, you know that this sound means you just made a sale.
Shopify has helped millions of businesses sell their products online, but did you know they also offer the same support for brick and mortar stores?
From accepting payments to managing inventory, they have everything you need to sell in person. So give your point of sale system a serious upgrade with Shopify.
Shopify POS tracks sales across all your locations. That way, you'll always know what you have in stock and where.
They also provide reliable tech that fits your unique retail needs, like turning a tablet into a credit card reader.
And if you're looking to reach new customers, check out Shopify's marketing tools. They're easy to use and they integrate with all social media platforms.
With Shopify, we have a powerful partner for managing our sales. And if you're a business owner, you can too.
Do retail right with Shopify.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period today at shopify.com/murder. And here's the important note, that promo code is all lowercase.
So go to shopify.com/murder and take your retail business to the next level.
That's shopify.com/murder. Again, don't forget, the code is all lowercase.
Goodbye. All right. My murder. Okay. So, you know, I'm obsessed with fucking infectious diseases and yes, plagues and flu epidemics.
Uh-oh.
You know I love all this shit, right?
Sure. Like,
that's my passion.
Mm-hmm. Illness?
Uh-huh. Like, end of days shit.
Great.
Level stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And right now, the flu, right now in mid-January 2018, the flu is already an epidemic.
Yeah.
This year, which is fun. I just got a shot.
Did you get a flu shot?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good.
I think it's irritated and I'm going to die. But anyways.
Well, at least you won't have the flu when you die.
Exactly. So on that note, because it's so fun, I thought I would do, you know, our good friend, Typhoid Mary.
Nice.
Okay. Here we go. In the summer of 1906, on Long Island's Oyster Bay. Have you been there? I haven't. I think they take one of those little trains.
A jitney
to get there. Right?
I don't know.
1906, a jitney? Did they have cars?
It was made of straw.
Don't know. Maybe a horse jitney. So Long Island's Oyster Bay is the Tony playground of New York's rich and famous. Teddy fucking Roosevelt, none other than, had his summer White House there.
Oh.
It's all fucking rich people.
Sure.
Everyone freaks the fuck out when, in a span of just 1 week, 6 of the 11 people in the home of wealthy banker, also he's the banker to the Vanderbilts even,
ooh,
Charles Warren's household, comes down with typhoid fever while they are there on vacation. Typhoid is a bacterial infection. Let me tell you about it.
Okay.
Due to Salmonella typhi. And it's viewed back then as a disease of the crowded slums and tenements, which we love to talk about.
Yes.
In New York, it's associated with poverty, the lack of basic sanitation. Immigrants assumed to live in disease-ridden, crowded housing are scapegoats of typhoid. So when a rich fucking family gets it, it's bananas. Typhoid is one of the 20th century's most terrifying killers because an infection could spread through a house before anyone knew what was going on. The first week, the infection seems almost, you know, like just the regular flu. Then there's the fever, some abdominal cramping, but nothing really crazy to show that it's typhoid. And then during the second week, fever goes crazy. The patient becomes delirious. Blood clots form under the skin. The entire abdomen becomes distended.
Ooh.
The third week, inflammation of the fucking brain and intestinal hemorrhaging. And the death rate of those infected is anywhere between 1 in 10 and 3 in 10. So it's really easily spread by eating or drinking food or water contaminated with the feces of infected persons.
Ew, what?
So think about that in the 1900s, the early 1900s,
mm-mm,
you know, when they didn't like wash their hands and stuff and like water wasn't, you know, cleaned and shit. And they all lived in like houses and stuff that were all, you know.
Yeah, that was back still when people would get up and just pee in a bowl under the bed, right?
Right.
And just like slosh it back under.
Probably throw it out the window.
Sure.
Is that when they threw stuff out the window? Throw the baby out with the...
Probably. Man? I bet they did.
Let's say yes.
But I like the idea that people would do it in rich houses.
They didn't. So that's the thing.
Okay.
Like, they didn't. So it was really weird that this typhoid was an outbreak in a rich house. So people were... That's why on Oyster Bay, they were like, this is a fucking... Something's wrong.
Not here. Not in my family. Not in my backyard.
Right. Not in the Tony playground of the rich and famous.
Hell no.
No. In 1900, it killed 35,000 Americans. There's no cure. Antibiotics didn't exist. And a vaccine was not yet available.
Horrifying.
So... scary. So the Charles Warren's landlord was freaking out that the family outbreak would prevent him from leasing his summer house again. He thought they would burn it to the fucking ground because of typhoid. So he's like, fuck this shit. He hires freelance sanitary engineer George Soper. Dr. George Soper.
Okay.
Which is like, you sound fun at parties.
You right? sound like you have a made up job.
Yeah.
He's called a janitor.
No. He's like, he investigates sources of typhoid fever outbreaks to determine the cause. Like, he's the dude who
House?
Is like
Dr. House.
He's fucking House. He's like, come over to my house, figure out what happened here.
Okay,
like, why is everyone sick? He's the dude who figures it out. Like,
what was his name again?
George Soper, Dr. George Soper.
Okay,
so he's like, what's his name? The detective,
Columbo, Sherlock Holmes.
Can you edit that? You can leave that part in. He's like the Columbo Sherlock Holmes of diseases.
Okay.
Okay.
Of, I was going to say diarrhea. What? Stop it.
We don't use that word. No, please. We do use that word. So Soper tests everything. He's like super excited about gross stuff. Sure. Apparently he tests the house plumbing, local shellfish company, everything comes up negative for typhoid. But then he looks into the cook who had worked for the Warrens weeks before the outbreak and discovered that a female Irish cook who fit the description of a cook who had worked in other households where typhoid had broken out in the past, that she had worked there right before everyone fell ill of typhoid, and had also just cooked for the Warrens. So
I don't know why you'd hire a Irish cook. We can't fucking cook. It's apparently all pot roast and it. Like red potatoes.
Yeah, but I think that back then they liked the simplicity of it all.
Oh man, such a bummer. I mean, Irish.
That sounds fucking amazing to me. That's all I want is pot roast and red potatoes.
Are you serious?
With some horseradish. Yes.
What about Jello with fruit cocktail floating inside of it?
Fruit cocktail, yes.
Yeah. And then, of course, my grandma's special.
What did she put on it?
Thousand Island dressing. Yes.
Okay, hard stop.
That's an iceberg lettuce.
No.
That's Irish cooking, my friends.
Do you know what I want? I want iceberg lettuce with Thousand Island, and I want Jello with fruit cocktail. I don't want them to meet each other.
Well, sorry. My grandma says you have to. And that's my job to make it happen.
And you have to finish it.
You do.
I mean, fair enough.
Maybe she forced us to eat spinach as tiny babies, and very few of us have ever broken a bone.
Spinach. But you fucking twist your ankle all the goddamn time.
I roll it, but it don't break.
Grandma. Okay.
Grandma.
He was, okay, so he can't find her because she left after every outbreak begins, she fucking laters out of there and doesn't give a forwarding address. Soper learns of an active outbreak in a penthouse on Park Avenue where two of the household servants were hospitalized and the young daughter of the family had died of typhoid.
Oh, no.
And Soper discovers that the family cook was the same woman who had cooked for the other families. It's 40-year-old Irish immigrant Mary Mallon.
Ugh, Mary, wash your hands, Mary.
There we go.
What are you doing, Mary?
And what does she say?
And she says, ugh, I just need to stir the soup with my hand real quick. I can't do it.
No, you're going to do it this whole fucking story. We need it. Okay, Soper starts stalking Mary Mallon and tells her, and he tells her she's transmitting disease and death by her job. But he sounds very bad at, like, telling people things and explaining in a calm, like, you know, self-possessed manner to an Irish immigrant, probably because he had some prejudices against Irish people.
So do you think he was, like, too nervous to tell her, or he was, like, screaming at her?
I think he was screaming in her face, this thing of, you're transmitting disease and death. And she's this, like, Irish immigrant. He's like, what are you talking about?
Ah.
Ah. So he didn't explain to her how she, as a woman who was perfectly healthy, could be infecting others with typhoid. He attempted to get, and then he goes on to attempt to get samples of Mary's feces, urine, and blood. I think just by yelling in her face that he needs samples of her feces, urine, and blood.
Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, man, get away from me.
Yeah. Not surprisingly, this just pissed Mary off. And one time she chased him away with a large kitchen fork when he tried to come get her feces. Get out of here. I don't know. That's my Irish. Get out of here.
Get out of the kitchen now. Yeah, you always have to start way high and then go down really low.
Okay. Since Mary refused to give samples, he decided to compile a 5-year history of her employment. Ooh. He found that of the 8 families that had hired Mary Mallon as a cook, members of 7 of those families claimed to have contracted typhoid fever, even though Mary had never shown signs of the ailment. And with this, Soper becomes the first author to describe a healthy carrier of salmonella typhi in the United States. So the person who can carry it, never get ill by it, but pass it on to other people. So that's, she's basically immune to this thing she has.
But she has it and is giving it to everybody else.
And she, and part of her argument is like, well, I'm fucking fine. It can't be me giving it to anyone.
Right.
So
also, and let me use my whole arm as a stirring spoon.
And I just want to stir this fucking stew.
I just want to touch the bottom of the pan.
Right. With my fingernail. Let me put this under my fingernails and put it into the stew.
What's the big deal?
What is the problem?
My fingernail ladle.
Right. Without washing my hands. Okay. Let me tell you about Mary. Mary Mallon was born in September of 1869 in Cooks County, Cookston, County, Tyrone, Cookston, let's call it. a small village in the north of Ireland that was among one of Ireland's poorest areas. She immigrated to the United States in 1883 at the age of 15. Her aunt and uncle, who she had been living with, died. So she was living in squalid housing in the Lower East Side, fending for herself. She found work as a domestic servant, and apparently her proclivity in the kitchen led her to be a cook. So she was somehow
her
good.
What in the kitchen?
I don't know. I've copied and pasted a Sorry. Word that I never use. Proclivity.
Propensity?
Clensity. Clensity. That's a word.
I don't think it is.
Oh, shit. Hold on. I refuse. I copied and pasted it. Oh, no. It sounded so good, and I was going to...
It kind of is like the combination of propensity and declension, but I'm almost positive.
Glenn, your search for propensity did not match any search document. Her propensity... Is that right? Well, I'm never copying and pasting from Wikipedia again.
That's grammar's odd. So it's not, there's no.
Yeah, there's no, it's propensity. Okay. Or that's the correct.
Oh, yeah. Maybe they just.
The correct word is propensity. Fuck. All right. I'm not editing that out because this is who I am.
Look.
I'm in a fucking show sometimes. We get words wrong. It's okay.
My proclenston in the kitchen.
It sounds like proclenston sounds like a for men who are losing their hair, yes. Like a shampoo.
Take mint proclenston every night.
Right. Okay. In 1900, she worked in Mamaroneck, New York. Heard of it?
Nope.
Where within 2 weeks of her employment, residents developed typhoid fever. In 1901, she moved to Manhattan, where members of the family whom she worked for developed fevers and diarrhea. That's a bummer to have at the same time.
Yeah, right? That's horrible. You don't know what's happening and you have diarrhea?
Right.
Jesus.
The laundress died there.
Oh, no.
Whose name they don't mention anywhere, which is like, listen, she's someone too.
That's right.
And then Mary Mellon goes on to work for a lawyer. She left after 7 of the 8 people in that household became ill. She fucking laters.
Why does she keep leaving, though?
I don't know.
She thinks she's so innocent.
Well, it's hard to tell because it's like, did she leave because everyone got sick and so the house stood still and they didn't need anyone? Or what did she know?
Isn't that when you need help the most?
It's true. Chicken soup doesn't cook itself. Or
yeah,
stir
that's
itself.
Right.
Chicken soup
or
doesn't
walk itself
its
up
own
those stairs.
Arm to yeah. Stir itself. Jesus Christ. Okay.
Chicken soup can't stir itself without an arm and it can't walk upstairs.
Exactly. So... Okay, so then in 1906, she goes to Oyster Bay, and within 2 weeks, 10 of the 11 family members are hospitalized with typhoid. Changes job again, same thing happens. Cooks for the Warren, same thing happens. Blah, blah, blah. Okay, doctors theorize that Mary Mellon likely passed typhoid germs by failing to vigorously scrub her hands before handling food.
Oh.
Usually the elevated temperatures of cooking food would have killed all the germs and bacteria and shit. But then they found out that Mary Mellon's most popular dish.
Her specialty
was ice cream that she cut up raw peaches into and froze. So nothing had gotten cooked.
Oh.
And can you imagine those wet fucking peaches with her little cutting knife under and all the nail under her nail stuff.
As she's cutting peaches, she's also cutting a little bit of her finger along with it.
Oh God.
She had a real proclivity for cutting up her own flesh.
I can't believe I got that word wrong. Okay. The New York City Health Department finally they try to get her to chill the fuck out, and she won't. Finally, they send physicians.
She won't.
She's like, fuck you to everyone.
I must cook. Yeah.
She's like an angry woman.
She had to fight for her, her livelihood. She didn't have anybody.
Nobody. It reminds, so I just started watching Alias Grace, which you had talked about liking, and it reminds me of she came over on a ship in that fucking, in that nature of absolute bullshit. And
yes.
She's like, fuck you, I'm working to live my own life.
I mean, it's those, the ship journey alone, ugh, so upsetting for most people, yeah, coming to this country.
Traumatizing.
Just horrifying. And then they show up and then it's like, I hope you have a job.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah.
Also, you don't wash your hands enough.
Yeah, that's
right. What are you talking about?
You know what that reminds me of real quick?
Yeah.
When I lived in Scotland, there was a commercial that was on like UK TV, and it was, are you a washer or a walker? And it was just a it was pretend camera, like hidden camera in a bathroom to see if people walked up, checked their face and walked away, or washed their hands and walked away. And since that commercial, I think before that I was very like, nah, who cares one way or the other? Yeah. I know if I need to wash my hands or not. Since that commercial, I wash my hands every single time,
no
matter what.
You just can't trust doorknobs. You just can't trust door handles.
You just should wash your hands as much as possible.
And I do. I mean, don't go out of your fucking mind.
And I do.
But like, do your best.
Don't be a walker. That's all I'm saying.
My dad, he won't sit down at, we'll go to lunch anywhere. He had just gotten out of his car. He hasn't touched anything. He's kind of has OCD though, but he'll go wash his hands before sit, like every time. You can't even start talking to him.
Oh,
he'll
wow.
go wash his hands.
I wonder if that's like, if his parents were really strict about that, like before eating.
Yeah, maybe.
It's a good idea. Every once in a while, I'll look at my hands, especially when I was wearing cheap jeans.
Oh, no.
When you, there's nothing worse than having dirty hands as an adult at like a meal.
Well, there's nothing worse than like putting a food thing into your mouth and being like, when was the last time I washed my hands? That's my fucking thing of like, and then there's only so many times you can go, well, I'm strengthening my immune system.
Right.
No, most of the time you're not. You're just putting someone else's fucking urine hands in your fucking mouth and from the doorknob.
We'd all have much stronger immune systems if that really was
right.
The truth.
I have a bit of an OCD about washing hands.
Well, you're Marty's daughter.
I'm Marty's daughter through and through. A hard Stark doesn't let her hands get
dirty.
Does not mess. Okay. So New York City Health Department sends in physician Sarah Josephine Baker to talk to Mary. So
the singer?
Yeah, right? Almost.
That'd be amazing. At night, she was this amazing dancer.
Yeah, hands up, gross. That's not good. Baker said that by the time she said, quote, by that time, she was convinced that the law was only persecuting her when she had done nothing wrong. So Mary was like, hardcore, fuck you.
Yeah. We're like that.
Yeah. Baker's. So this chick, Sarah Josephine Baker, her own father and brother had died of typhoid when she was young. And so she had felt pressure to support her mother and sister financially. So at 16 years old, she decided on a career in medicine.
Wow.
And this is like the early 1900s, late 1800s. This chick is a badass motherfucker in her own right. And people should fucking study her, et cetera, for feminist reasons. She's fucking awesome. So she goes to find Mary Mallon, and with her help, the New York City Health Department takes Mary into custody in 1907 and places her into forced confinement inside a bungalow on 16-acre North Brother Island off the Bronx Shore. So if you have lived in Manhattan or been in Manhattan, you see the fucking island over there. Like, ooh, off the shore that you can like see. It's almost like Alcatraz in San Francisco.
Right.
So the only companion she has, and tell me if this doesn't sound amazing, she's in confinement and all she has is a fox terrier. And you're like, living the life. Can I please?
So wait, I think I'm in that confinement right now.
You put yourself in Mary Mallon's fucking confinement.
We're all Irish women are doomed to live the life of Mary Mallon.
It just repeats itself.
Damn it.
Okay, so they on this Brother Island was the Riverside Hospital, which is where she's at. It's founded in the 1850s as a smallpox hospital to treat and isolate victims of that disease. So they just fucking put them on this tiny island outside of Manhattan, and you can see Manhattan, and you're like, oh, I want that. And they're like, no, you're sick.
Too bad.
It eventually expands to other quarantinable diseases like leprosy and venereal diseases. So they just like later people onto that island.
Did they really?
Yeah.
So you get some venereal disease and then
they're like, go stay here until you're
In the same room with all the other people with venereal diseases.
Yeah. That sounds like a party.
I mean, those are the people that party.
Yeah.
A lot of great personalities in that room, I bet.
I mean, I'm sure. Okay. With her forced confinement, Mary Mallon, everyone, the media goes fucking nuts because this woman has been spreading this disease and killing people with it. So media goes nuts. Eventually in 1908, in the Journal of American Medical Association, she is nicknamed Typhoid Mary. That's where she gets her name.
So the professionals really they came just, in to shit on her.
Yeah, they were doing top-notch journalism.
All right. Good job, everybody.
So it turns out Mary Mallon is immune to the disease herself. She's the first person in the United States identified as an asymptomatic carrier of the pathogen, which is pretty fucking cool. Mm-hmm. While in custody, Mary Mallon, Typhoid Mary, let's call her, admits to poor hygiene. She's like, yeah, what of it, motherfuckers?
Oh,
say it,
no.
Say it in Irish.
I can't say.
That was perfect. That was all you just say.
Who cares? Jesus, Mary and Joseph, there's other things to worry about.
Exactly.
There's people starving in my country.
She said she did not understand the purpose of hand washing because she did not pose a risk.
Girl, you're the cook.
You're the cook. You pose a risk. It doesn't matter how healthy you are. Authorities are like, let's get rid of your gallbladder because that's where they believe the typhoid bacteria resided in. And she was like, fuck no, fuck you. I don't even have the disease. And she was unwilling to cease working as a cook too. So like, we'll let you go. Just don't work as a cook. And she's like, nope, I now won't wash my hands. Go fuck yourself.
Fight, Mary, fight. We're so angry. It doesn't make sense. Irish women, fight. And then a herky.
She is forced to give 163 samples of various bodily substances to the doctors there, 120 of which tested positive for the bacteria.
She was teeming with this disease.
To the gills. So Mary stays there for 3 years until test results from a private laboratory, yes, I said that, came up negative for typhoid. And with this information in 1909, Mary sues the health department for her freedom. But everyone's like, where did she get the money to sue the health department? And then it's like a secret thing that maybe William Randolph Hearst was like, well, I'll give you the money if you give me like an interview. So like he was like springing people. So
genius.
Yeah, so smart. But the New York Supreme Court's like, go fuck yourself. No. But then in 1910, there's a new health commissioner. He lets her go if she promises never to work as a cook again. And she's like, okay, great.
She's like, fine, I didn't like it that much anyway.
Yeah. So in February of 1910, Mary agreed that she was, quote, prepared to change her occupation and would give assurance by affidavit that she would, upon her release, take such hygienic precautions as would protect those with whom she came in contact from infection. Meaning, wash your fucking hands. I'll wash my fucking hands.
No, I felt like I wanted to defend, but it's indefensible.
Go ahead.
No, I can't.
Some people think that her being locked up is indefensible.
No, she killed a ton of people because she refused to wash. It's like she wouldn't give in anything.
Right.
Where it's like, okay, well, if you're the cook, you have to admit hand washing is kind of key. I realize that was kind of a new idea back then, but still.
Well, the thing is, so she thought they were all out to get her, all this shit. You're like decades later, they're like, well, if she had typhoid her whole life, maybe it fucked her brain up a little bit and she was paranoid and crazy.
Ooh.
Yeah. But wait, it gets worse.
Okay.
Okay. So they let her out. They lose track of her. Goodbye. Bad idea. Cut to 5 years later, in 1915, a typhoid outbreak happens at Manhattan's Sloan Maternity Hospital. Mm-mm. It struck 25 workers and killed two of those workers. When Soper, our friend George Soper's back, he looks into the outbreak and he's like, this looks fucking familiar.
Oh, no.
Traces it back to the cook, who's an Irish woman named Mary Brown this time. She changed her name.
Ugh. She found a good man.
Nope. She changed her name so she could become a cook. Like, she was doing it. Now she's responsible for it.
Now she's being a dick.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Now it's criminal, I think. It's Mary Mallon. Blah, blah, blah. Turns out she changed her name, and during her years of release, she had cooked in hotels, restaurants, and institutions.
Wow.
So she was like, they'd given her a job as a laundress. You make no fucking money. It's really hard work.
Doesn't smell good.
She was like, fuck this shit, and went to cook. Wherever she worked, there were outbreaks of typhoid. However, she changed jobs so frequently, so she had eluded the blame. She's captured and again confined to North Brother Island, where she continued to refuse to acknowledge that she had any connection between herself and the typhoid cases.
Well, at that point, it's so stacked up against her that she might as well just do that because she's so guilty that the second she breaks, it's over.
Yeah, exactly. So after the second apprehension, she spends the next 23 years of her life as a prisoner in forced isolation. Hundreds, if not thousands, of asymptomatic carriers who had been identified were allowed to walk the streets of New York freely, but Typhoid Mary lived alone in exile, partly due because the public were fucking pissed at her because she wouldn't stay out of the kitchen. Like, if she had just not gone back to cooking.
Yes. That second time around.
Exactly.
She, I mean, I didn't, it's sad that she lived in isolation.
Yeah.
But you, why are you being so stubborn?
Yeah. Calm down.
Karen.
Uh-oh. Oh, Karen's having family.
Then you just, my face just starts to fall apart. I don't want to do it. It just so comes out of me.
Your typhoid tears just start running out your face.
The devil inside me. He's so mad.
State of the kitchen. On November 11, 1938, Mary Mallon dies of pneumonia at age 69, still in captivity. An autopsy found evidence of live typhoid bacteria in her gallbladder. So
they were right.
Yeah, they were right. Her body's cremated and her ashes were buried at St. Raymond's Cemetery in the Bronx. So Mary Mallon, it's thought that she infected 51 people and three of those illnesses resulted in death. And that's based on, George Soper's, you know, looking into it. But she used so many aliases that it's thought that the true death toll could have been way fucking higher. Some estimated that she had have caused 50 fatalities, which I just saw that in a random article. So I don't know if that's even true. Historians say she contaminated at least 122 people and killed five, which sounds a little more likely.
So crazy, though.
Yeah. So throughout the 20th century, typhoid fever steadily declines due to introduction of vaccinations and improvements in public sanitation and hygiene, aka wash your fucking hands. And today, typhoid fever is considered a rare condition among developed countries. Rate is approximately 5 cases per million per year. As for fucking Brother Island and Riverside Hospital, real quick, this fucking island of disease off the Manhattan. Sounds amazing, right?
Sounds amazing.
The island has been abandoned since 1963 after it was last a detention facility for juvenile drug offenders in 1963. How badly do you wish you could go and just sit on the wall and like stare at people?
There's some blacklight posters in that building. That
you know there's some people out there who have stories of like...
They were like... You know, my mom working in the mental, she worked at a hospital called Langley Porter in San Francisco. Uh-huh. It's up on the hill.
Yeah.
Kind of. And people in the 60s used to send their kids. They got caught smoking pot one time.
No.
They sent their kids to the mental hospital.
Jesus Christ.
So she said there were in the mid to late 60s, all these kids, there was like an influx of kids who were like, they're incorrigible and they're drug addicts, yeah, where they had only done like smoked one joint or just whatever. Like,
we're saying no to things.
Exactly.
And it was like, but they were housed with people who are legitimately in need of mental
health issues.
And I'm sure those kids were like, well, I'm never doing anything bad again.
Yes. The shit that they saw, like, yeah. Or they were like, I don't know. She just said it was really sad and it bummed her out a lot.
It's clearly complicated. Yeah, so these kids got sent there in 1963. Finally, it closed. It's now uninhabited and designated as a bird sanctuary. But wait, it's illegal for anyone to go on the island without permission from the city. All the buildings, though, still fucking stand.
Ugh.
And these photographers sometimes go on there and take photos, and you can see a bunch of the photos. We should put them up on Instagram of these gorgeous, like, brick buildings that are falling into disrepair. And you can see the rooms where Mary Mallon was fucking housed. And you can see the typhoid wing. And you can see the fucking crematorium, and it's like, it's insanely gorgeous. I am asking any murderino who works for the city of Manhattan to please let me and Karen come see the fucking island.
Come and get a disease of our own for ourselves.
And since it's like under watch, and it's really hard to get on there, everything is still there. So like, people haven't graffitied and people haven't stolen shit from the island.
That's amazing.
You need to see the photos. Everything is covered in wildlife. It's gorgeous.
Oh, I want to see that.
It's amazing.
It sounds like the island they threatened to send, or that they promised to send Dr. Lecter to, mm-hmm, in Silence of the Lambs. Ooh. That ends up to be that they were like
fakesies
when she recites that thing. Oh, you are allowed allowed to walk on the beach every day, whatever.
I want to read that. It's so good. Do it again.
And you will be allowed one. You will be allowed one. one day a year where you can walk freely on the beach with armed guards or whatever, snipers.
Oh, God.
I don't know.
And she didn't know it was fake either.
I know. My friend Amy, who you met when we were in Wisconsin, she has Silence of the Lambs memorized.
I love that.
I've watched it with her, and she'll just say the line real quick before. It's my favorite thing in the world.
Oh, I love it.
You will be allowed to walk. She'd be able to do that speech right off the dome.
It's so good.
I love
it. Oh, these domes. Okay, it's illegal, blah, 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 but you could still see the building, the room where Typhoid Mary spent the last 23 years of her life.
What's she doing there?
Oh, man, she was bummed. But it's just like there's varying accounts where it's like some say she was like actually helping out there and like a maid, and some say that she was just like in seclusion and they abandoned her and used her as like a look at Typhoid Mary, you know, when people would come to the island.
Yeah.
It's like that kind of thing. So you don't really know. I hope there was a fox terrier.
I just hope so.
Yeah. And then I also want to mention there's a podcast, if you're into this shit like I am, there's a podcast that's kind of new. It's hosted by these two young ladies who are grad students in disease ecology.
Ooh.
It's called This Podcast Will Kill You. And it's just about infectious diseases from history. And every episode is that. And these two girls are named, they're both named Erin, are like, it's just an awesome podcast.
This podcast will kill you.
I love it.
I like to imagine that Typhoid Mary sat in seclusion in her room on that island and fantasized of all the different things she'd like to put her hand in. So then, like, she'd be like corn chowder or whatever, and then just like mashed potatoes, and then both hands. The fantasy is just like both bare arms go all the way in,
and then like she cleans her fingernails in the chowder.
Yes,
I wonder if she like requested like cooking magazines and like read recipes and was like stick your arm completely in.
She'd be like, this looks good, but you know what it needs. My arm,
my fingernail clippings. And it's not funny. People don't.
It's disgusting.
It's terrible. But isn't that amazing?
It's incredible. Yeah. Also, the idea, did you watch The Nick when it was on?
Yeah, and they have there's an episode involving her. I watched the little scene where
where they confront her.
Yeah.
That was such a good show, and they did that around Small World.
So good.
She was great. But they did that where they would take those things out of history and be like, where you don't have any sense, like things before modern medicine and modern stuff. It's just the weirdest idea where they'd be like, somebody coming in, they'd be like, well, we tried to stick a tube in their arm and then they died, like the end. Or it's just, it was so crazy precarious back
then.
The
Nick is such a great show.
I love that show.
If you're into that kind of thing, you should definitely watch it.
It was great. Also, if you've ever taken cocaine to the point where it was a problem for you, I warn.
Trigger warning.
Huge cocaine trigger warning for the Nick.
Opium, too.
You're like, I could be a doctor and do coke all the time. Yeah. No.
Maybe you're into opium dens, too. Trigger warning.
So warning, if you love to lay back with a bunch of people dressed in a traditional Chinese garb,
then this will be hard for you to get through.
It's going to make you nuts.
But if you love surgery without gloves or anesthesia, this is the show for you.
What a show. Or Clive Owen.
Right.
That was great.
Thank you.
That was fun. I love to learn.
I love teaching. No. I love saying words wrong.
I love teaching. I love to learn. I love to lie.
I love to make up new words.
I love to just have fun with it.
Just say shit that don't have any proclivity for caring.
I mean, I have a real proclivity to just say what I want. And I think we all do. There's a freedom in that. In these proclivities we all have.
In this proclivious time, there's a freedom.
It's so... The funniest thing about Typhoid Mary is she had a real problem with proclivity. Shit.
No, I love it. It was a fucking valiant effort.
I tried, but you could see me. Ooh. You could see me making that U-turn from miles away.
Would you have made that attempt 2 years ago before this podcast? Absolutely not.
No, not at all. And so I applaud you. Real bias against puns, as you know.
And so I applaud you.
And no, I think it's the effect that you have on my life.
I'm making you stupider.
You're breaking down those pun walls.
I am stupidering you hard. You know,
real hard.
What makes you happy?
Let's see. Falling down and snapping my ankle loudly in front of my neighbors.
Oh, no. I kind of have one.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, the thing that makes me happy this week is this book that I'm listening to. Thank you, Audible. It's sci-fi fantasy, and it's one of those books that makes me... that someone thought of this narrative and thought of this, like, you know, idea makes me happy that certain humans exist. You know, it's like so fucking joyous that like people can think of these things and write these books, and it's gorgeous and I love it. It's called Children of Time by Adrian Tchaikovsky. Mm. And it's sci-fi fantasy. The book is really fun to listen to. It's fucking weird as shit. It's like post-human space stuff with there's spiders. I've never in my life thought I would ever have sympathy to spiders, but I do. It's like such a good book, and it's making me really happy to exist.
Wow, that's great.
And Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, you know, like that's the last book that's done that for me, which has made me like so happy that Douglas Adams existed and I get to live like here.
Big theories and thoughts and feelings.
Yeah. I'm like, wow, someone thought of that. Our brains are bigger than, you know, in these preclensish times.
Where everything feels kind of preclensing.
Right. And I know I'm not going to write that fucking book. So I appreciate that Adrian Tchaikovsky has.
Yeah.
So
that's really sat down and pounded it out.
Yeah. So that's making me happy.
Agreed. Agreed.
What's yours?
Okay. Mine is, this was a tweet that I received 2 days ago. You did too. From a woman named Molly on,
hold on.
Oh, sorry. Haunted Train.
That is so fucking loud.
It's me Chernick on Twitter. And she wrote to us and said, don't be alarmed if there's a body down there, in quotes. And then the headline of the article that she sent us says, sinkhole reveals hidden room below family's garage.
That's right.
And then there's a picture of shelving that they can see through the hole. And on the shelf, there's toys, but it's also all dark and creepy. And it's like this article. So it happened in Idaho Falls, Idaho. This family... apparently when they like there's like an inch of cement and then the sinkhole happened and basically there had been a hidden room underneath their house, and it's in a place where there's normally not cellars,
right?
So they're like, they think it's possible that could have been like a bomb shelter, but probably not. And a bunch of stuff that's down there has been down there for like 40 or 50 years.
Is that how, like, I couldn't find how long it was. It's like 40 or 50 years.
I don't think that they were
knew. Letters and shit.
Yes. But they,
that's the craziest.
Let me see if I can get a year. The home was built in the 50s, and it was built as a basement home. Then someone came in the 70s and remodeled it and added the second story.
So I bet in the 70s someone put it down there.
Yeah. But they say it's definitely not a bomb shelter, and that it's sketchy. And the insurance provider and the engineer are the ones that said, don't be alarmed if you find a body down there.
That's amazing. Don't be alarmed if you find a body down there.
Because they're basically going down there and looking through. It's just... like that picture of the old kind of water moldy letters and stuff. It's just the creepiest story of all time. So I'm very, as I think you know, but I'm not sure if everybody knows, but I'm obsessed with sinkholes.
Sinkholes
are truly my passion. Anytime they come, I was never more livid. Remember the sinkhole that came up off of Laurel Canyon?
Yeah.
I was up in Petaluma.
Last year.
I saw it on the news and I was livid.
Because you couldn't go meet it in person?
Yeah.
Couldn't you go to meet and greet?
I would have walked right down there. I would have paid top dollar for that meet and greet. I've been like, hi, where did you come from?
What's your deal?
What's happening down there? Is it a, are you a hidden river?
Oh.
Or are you something entirely different?
That's so amazing.
Yeah. Sinkhole and hidden room. Come on.
My favorite sinkhole. That's amazing.
There's so many.
This is a doublesies for you. It's a sinkhole and a hidden room.
And because the best part about, usually sinkholes fill back up with water because that's why they're there in the first place. It's like the water table got too close. Blah-de-blah.
Look at you.
Well, it's made up. But but it's a water involved. Yeah, you know, that's why.
Sure.
It's erosion, but it's underneath.
Okay.
Anyhow, there's no water in this, in that cellar. It's like they can go down and look into it.
I know.
It's not like it got flooded immediately or filled with silt.
No, I want to go.
I want to go down there.
Let's go. It's like an amusement park. Let's go.
Idaho is not that far away.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Yeah, that was a fun one. Yeah. There's all kinds of crazy shit in that one.
Take it. Run with it.
Do your thing.
Do a fucking herky at the end of it.
Do a herky. Please, if you're going to correct me on the herky positioning,
don't do it.
You have to be a professional cheerleader. I'll only take emails from professional cheerleaders.
And you have to send a video of you doing a herk.
We need the correct herk. And then we'll play the audio of the visual of the video.
Then you go, and breaking your back.
Herky.
Herky. Thanks for listening, friends.
Stay sexy.
And don't get murdered.
Goodbye.
Bye. Elvis, you want a cookie? A cookie? Oh, that was a little one.